Book 6, Chapter I- Expedition of Julian into Persia. He was worsted and broke off Hy's life miserably. Letter written by Libanius, describing Hy's death. I have narrated in the preceding book the occurrences which took place in the church during the reign of Julian. 1. This emperor, having determined to carry on the war with Persia, made a rapid transit across the Euphrates in the beginning of spring, and, passing by Edessa from hatred to the inhabitants, who had long professed Christianity, he went on to Carpe, where there was a temple of Jupiter, in which he offered up sacrifice and prayer. He then selected 20,000 armed men from among his troops, and sent them towards the Tigris, in order that they might guard those regions, and also be ready to join him, in case he should require their assistance. He then wrote to Arsacius, king of Armenia, one of the Roman allies, to bespeak his aid in the war. In this letter Julian manifested the most unbounded arrogance. He boasted of the high qualities which had, he said, rendered him worthy of the empire, and acceptable to the gods for whom he cared. He reviled Constantius, his predecessor, as an effeminate and impious emperor, and threatened Arsacius in a grossly insulting way, and since he understood that he was a Christian, he intensified his insults, or eagerly and largely uttered unlawful blasphemies against Christ, for he was wont to dare this in every case. He told Arsacius that unless he acted according to his directions, the God in whom he trusted would not be able to defend him from his vengeance. When he considered that all his arrangements had been duly made, he led his army through Assyria. He took a great many towns and fortresses, either through treachery or by battle, and thoughtlessly proceeded onwards, without refleeting that he would have to return by the same route. He pillaged every place he approached, and pulled down or burnt the granaries and storehouses. As he was journeying up the Euphrates, he arrived at Ctesiphon, a very large city, whither the Persian monarchs have now transferred their residence from Babylon. The Tigris flows near this spot. As he was prevented from reaching the city with his ships, by a part of the land which separated it from the river, he judged that either he must pursue his journey by water, or quit his ships and go to Ctesiphon by land, and he interrogated the prisoners on the subject, having ascertained from them that there was a canal which had been blocked up in the course of time. He caused it to be cleared out, and, having thus effected a communication between the Euphrates and the Tigris, he proceeded towards the city, his ships floating along by the side of his army. But the Persians appeared on the banks of the Tigris with a formidable display of horse and many armed troops, of elephants, and of horses, and Julian became conscious that his army was besieged between two great rivers, and was in danger of perishing, either by remaining in its present position, or by retreating through the cities and villages which he had so utterly devastated that no provisions were attainable. Therefore he summoned the soldiers to see horse races, and proposed rewards to the fleetest racers. In the meantime he commanded the officers of the ships to throw over the provisions and baggage of the army, so that the soldiers, seeing themselves in danger by the want of necessaries, might turn about boldly and fight their enemies more desperately. After supper he sent for the generals and tribunes and commanded the embarkation of the troops. They sailed along the Tigris during the night and came at once to the opposite banks and disembarked, but their departure was perceived by some of the Persians, who exhorted one another to oppose them. But those still asleep the Romans readily overcame. At daybreak, the two armies engaged in battle, and after much bloodshed on both sides, the Romans returned by the river, and encamped near Ctesiphon. The emperor, being no longer desirous of proceeding further, burnt his vessels, as he considered that they required too many soldiers to guard them, and he then commenced his retreat along the Tigris, which was to his left. The prisoners, who acted as guides to the Romans, led them to a fertile country where they found abundance of provisions. Soon after, an old man who had resolved to die for the liberty of Persia, allowed himself to be taken prisoner, and was brought before the emperor. On being questioned as to the route, and seeming to speak the truth, he persuaded them to follow him as capable of transporting the army very speedily to the Roman frontiers. He observed that for the space of 3 or 4 days' journey this road would be difficult, and that it would be necessary to carry provisions during that time, as the surrounding country was sterile. The emperor was deceived by the discourse of this wise old man, and approved the march by this route. On advancing further, after the lapse of 3 days, they were cast upon an uncultivated region. The old prisoner was put to torture. He confessed that he had exposed himself voluntarily to death for the sake of his country, and was therefore prepared to endure any sufferings that could be inflicted on him. The Roman troops were now worn out by the length of the journey and the scarcity of provisions, and the Persians chose this moment to attack them. In the heat of the conflict which ensued, a violent wind arose, and the sky and the sun were totally concealed by the clouds, while the air was at the same time mixed with dust. During the darkness which was thus produced, a horseman, riding at full gallop, directed his lance against the emperor, and wounded him mortally. After throwing Julian from his horse, the unknown assailant secretly went away. Some conjectured that he was a Persian, others, that he was a Saracen. There are those who insist that he who struck the blow was a Roman soldier, who was indignant at the imprudence and temerity which the emperor had manifested in exposing his army to such peril. Libanius, 1, the Sophist, a native of Syria, the most intimate friend of Julian, expressed himself in the following terms concerning the person who had committed the deed: "You desire to know by whom the emperor was slain. I know not his name. We have a proof, however, that the murderer was not one of the enemies, for no one came forward to claim the reward, although the king of Persia caused proclamation to be made, by a herald, of the honors to be awarded to him who had performed the deed. We are surely beholden to the enemy for not arrogating to themselves the glory of the action, but for leaving it to us to seek the slayer among ourselves. Those who sought his death were those who lived in habitual transgression of the laws, and who had formerly conspired against him, and who therefore perpetrated the deed as soon as they could find an opportunity. They were impelled by the desire of obtaining a greater degree of freedom from all control than they could enjoy under his government, and they were, perhaps, mainly stimulated by their indignation at the attachment of the emperor to the service of the gods, to which they were averse." Chapter 2. He perished under divine wrath. Visions of the emperor's death seen by various individuals. Reply of the carpenter's son: "Julian tossed his blood aloft to Christ." Calamities which Julian entailed upon the Romans. In the document above quoted, Libanius clearly states that the emperor fell by the hand of a Christian, and this, probably, was the truth. 2. It is not unlikely that some of the soldiers who then served in the Roman army might have conceived the idea, since Greeks and all men until this day have praised tyrannicides for exposing themselves to death in the cause of liberty, and spiritedly standing by their country, their families, and their friends. Still less is he deserving of blame, who, for the sake of God and of religion, performed so bold a deed. Beyond this I know nothing accurately concerning the men who committed this murder besides what I have narrated. All men, however, concur in receiving the account which has been handed down to us, and which evidences his death to have been the result of divine wrath. A proof of this is the divine vision which one of his friends had, which I will now proceed to describe. He had, it is related, travelled into Persia, with the intention of joining the emperor. While on the road, he found himself so far from any habitation that he was obliged, on one night, to sleep in a church. He saw, during that night, either in a dream or a vision, all the apostles and prophets assembled together, and complaining of the injuries which the emperor had inflicted on the church, and consulting concerning the best measures to be adopted. After much deliberation and embarrassment to individuals arose in the midst of the assembly, desired the others to be of good cheer, and left the company hastily, as if to deprive Julian of the imperial power. He who was the spectator of this marvel did not attempt to pursue his journey, but awaited, in horrible suspense, the conclusion of this revelation. He laid himself down to sleep again, in the same place, and again, he saw the same assembly. The two individuals who had appeared to depart the preceding night to effect their purpose against Julian, suddenly returned and announced his death to the others. On the same day a vision was sent to Didymus, an ecclesiastical philosopher, who dwelt at Alexandria, and who, being deeply grieved at the errors of Julian and his persecution of the churches, fasted and offered up supplications to God continually on this account. From the effects of anxiety and want of food during the previous night, he fell asleep while sitting in his chair. Then being, as it were, in an ecstasy, he beheld white horses traversing the air, and heard a voice saying to those who were riding thereon, "Go and tell Didymus that Julian has been slain just at this hour. Let him communicate this intelligence to Athanasius, the bishop, and let him arise and eat. I have been credibly informed that the friend of Julian and the philosopher beheld those things." Results proved that neither of them were far from having witnessed the truth. But if these instances do not suffice to prove that the death of Julian was the effect of divine wrath on account of his persecution of the church, let the prediction of one of the ecclesiastics be called to mind. 1. When Julian was preparing to enter upon the war against the Persians, he threatened that on the termination of the war he would treat the Christians with severity, and boasted that the son of the carpenter would be unable to aid them. The ecclesiastic above mentioned thereupon rejoined, that the son of the carpenter was then preparing him a wooden coffin in view of his death. Julian himself was well aware whence the mortal stroke proceeded, and what was the cause of its infliction, for, it is said, when he was wounded, he took some of the blood that flowed from the wound, and threw it up into the air, as if he had seen Jesus Christ appearing, and intended to throw it at him, in order to reproach him with his slaughter. Others say that he was angry with the sun because it had favored the Persians, and had not rescued him, although, according to the doctrine of the astronomers, it had presided at his birth, and that it was to express his indignation against this luminary that he took blood in his hand and flung it upwards in the air. 2. I know not whether, on the approach of death, as is wont to be the case when the soul is in the act of being separated from the body and when it is enabled to behold diviner spectacles than are allotted to men, and so Julian might have beheld Christ. Few allusions have been made to this subject, and yet I dare not reject this hypothesis as absolutely false, for God often suffers still more improbable and astonishing events to take place in order to prove that the religion named after Christ is not sustained by human energy. It is, however, very obvious that, throughout the reign of this emperor, God gave manifest tokens of his displeasure, and permitted many calamities to befall several of the provinces of the Roman Empire. He visited the earth with such fearful earthquakes, that the buildings were shaken, and no more safety could be found within the houses than in the open air. From what I have heard, I conjecture that it was during the reign of this emperor, or, at least, when he occupied the second place in the government, that a great calamity occurred near Alexandria in Egypt. 3. When the sea receded and again passed beyond its boundaries from the reflux waves, and deluged a great deal of the land, so that on the retreat of the waters, the sea skiffs were found lodged on the roofs of the houses. The anniversary of this inundation, which they call the birthday of an earthquake, is still commemorated at Alexandria by a yearly festival. A general illumination is made throughout the city, they offer thankful prayers to God, and celebrate the day very brilliantly and piously. An excessive drought also occurred during this reign. The plants perished and the air was corrupted, and for want of proper sustenance, men were obliged to have recourse to the food usually eaten by other animals. The famine introduced peculiar diseases, by which many lives were lost. Such was the state of the empire during the administration of Julian. Chapter 3 – The reign of Jovian. He introduced many laws which he carried out in his government. After the decease of Julian, the government of the empire was, by the unanimous consent of the troops, tendered to Jovian. For, when the army was about to proclaim him emperor, he announced himself to be a Christian and refused the sovereignty, nor would he receive the symbols of empire. But when the soldiers discovered the cause of his refusal, they loudly proclaimed that they were themselves Christians. The dangerous and disturbed condition in which affairs had been left by Julian's strategy, and the sufferings of the army from famine in an enemy's country, compelled Jovian to conclude a peace with the Persians, and to cede to them some territories which had been formerly tributary to the Romans. Having learned from experience that the impiety of his predecessor had excited the wrath of God, and given rise to public calamities, he wrote without delay to the governors of the provinces, directing that the people should assemble together without fear in the churches, that they should serve God with reverence, and that they should receive the Christian faith as the only true religion. He restored to the churches and the clergy, to the widows and the virgins, the same immunities and every former dotation for the advantage and honor of religion, which had been granted by Constantine and his sons, and afterwards withdrawn by Julian. He commanded Secundus, 1, who was then a praetorian prefect, to constitute it a capital crime to marry any of the holy virgins, or even to regard them with unchaste desires and to carry them off. He enacted this law, 2, on account of the wickedness which had prevailed during the reign of Julian, for many had taken wives from among the holy virgins, and, either by force or guile, had completely corrupted them, and thence had proceeded that indulgence of disgraceful lusts with impunity, which always occur when religion is abused. Chapter 4-Troubles again arise in the churches. Synod of Antioch, in which the Nicene faith is confirmed, the points which Thys important synod wrote about to Jovian. The presidents of the churches now resumed the agitation of doctrinal questions and discussions. 3. They had remained quiet during the reign of Julian when Christianity itself was endangered, and had unanimously offered up their supplications for the mercy of God. It is thus that men, when attacked by foreign enemies, remain in accord among themselves. But, when external troubles are removed, then internal dissensions creep in. This, however, is not a proper place for the citation of the numerous examples in governments and nations which history affords of this fact. At this period Basil, bishop of Ancyra, Silvanus, bishop of Tarsus, Sophronius, bishop of Pompeiopolis, and others of their party who regarded the heresy of the Onomians, so called, with the utmost aversion, and received the term similar as to substance, instead of the term consubstantial, wrote a treatise to the emperor, and after expressing their thankfulness to God for his accession to the empire, besought him to confirm the decrees issued at Ariminum and Seleucia, and to annul what had been established merely by the zeal and power of certain individuals. They also entreated that, if division, which existed on account of the synods, should still prevail in the churches, the bishops from every region might be convened alone in some place indicated by the emperor, and not be permitted to assemble elsewhere and issue decrees at variance with each other, as had been done during the reign of Constantius. They added that they had not gone to visit him at his camp, because they were fearful of being burdensome to him, but that if he desired to see them, they would gladly repair to him, and defray all the expenses attendant on the journey themselves. Such was the document written to the emperor Jovian. At this juncture a council was convened at Antioch in Syria. The form of belief established by the Council of Nicaea was confirmed, and it was decided that the Son is incontrovertibly of the same substance as the Father. Meletius, who then governed the Church of Antioch, Eusebius, bishop of Samosata, Pelagius, bishop of Laodicea in Syria, Acacius, bishop of Caesarea in Palestine, Aeneas, bishop of Gaza, and Athanasius, bishop of Ancyra, took part in this council. On the termination of the council they acquainted the emperor with the transactions that had taken place, by dispatching the following letter, 4, to the most religious and God-beloved Augustus, our sovereign Jovian, the conqueror, from the bishops assembled from divers regions, at Antioch. We know, O emperor, well-beloved of God, that your party is fully intent upon maintaining peace and concord in the church. Neither are we ignorant that you have well received the impress of the chief point of such unity, viz. The true and orthodox faith. Lest, therefore, we should be reckoned among those who assail these doctrines of truth, we attest to your piety that we receive and maintain the form of belief which was anciently set forth by the Holy Council of Nicaea. Now, although the term consubstantial appears strange to some persons, yet it was safely interpreted by the fathers, and signifies that the Son was begotten of the substance of the Father. This term does not convey the idea of unbroken generation, neither does it coincide with the use which the Greeks make of the word substance, but it is calculated to withstand the impious and rash allegation of Arius, that the Son proceeded from what had had no previous existence. The Anomians who have just sprung up have the shameless boldness to maintain this word to the grief of the concord of the Church. We subjoin to this letter a copy of the formulary of faith adopted by the bishops assembled at Nicaea, which we also cherish. Such were the decisions formed by the priests convened at Antioch, and they appended to their letter a copy of the Nicene formulary of faith. Chapter 5. Athanasius the Great is very highly esteemed by the emperor, and rules over the churches of Egypt. Vision of Antony the Great. At this period, 1. Athanasius, who governed the see of Alexandria, and some of his friends, deemed it requisite, as the emperor was a Christian, to repair to his court. 2. Accordingly Athanasius went to Antioch, and laid such matters before the emperor as he deemed expedient. Others, however, say that the emperor sent for him in order to consult him concerning the affairs relative to religion and the right tenet. When the business of the church had as far as possible been transacted, Athanasius began to think of returning. Ousoas, bishop of the Arian heresy in Antioch, endeavored to install Probitius, a eunuch who held the same sentiments as himself, in Alexandria. The whole party of Ousoas conspired with him to effect this design, and Lucius, a citizen of Alexandria, who had been ordained presbyter by George, endeavored to prejudice the emperor against Athanasius, by representing, 3, that he had been accused of divers crimes and had been condemned to perpetual banishment by preceding emperors, as the author of the dissensions and troubles of the church concerning the divine being. Lucius likewise besought Jovian to appoint another bishop over the church of Alexandria. The emperor, since he knew the plots which had happened against Athanasius, attached no credit to the calumny, and with threatening, commanded Lucius to retire quietly. He also ordered Probitius and the other eunuchs belonging to his palace, whom he regarded as the originators of these troubles, to act more advisedly. From that period Jovian manifested the greatest friendship towards Athanasius, and sent him back to Egypt, with directions to govern the churches and people of that country as he might think fit. It is also said that he passed commendations on the virtue of the bishop, on his life, his intellectual endowments, and his eloquence. Thus, after having been exposed to opposition for a long while, as has been narrated in the former books, was the Nicene faith fully re-established under the present government, but further embarrassment awaited it within a very short period. 4. As it appeared afterwards, the whole of the prediction of Antony the monk was not fulfilled by the occurrences which befell the church during the reign of Constantius. Part thereof was not accomplished until the reign of Valens. It is said that before the Arians got control of the churches during the reign of Constantius, Antony had a dream in which he saw mules kicking the altar with their hoofs and overturning the holy table. On awakening, he immediately predicted that the church would be troubled by the introduction of spurious and mixed doctrines, and by the rebellion of the heterodox. The truth of this prediction was evidenced by the events which occurred before and after the period now under review.